is already the size limit of what's allowed for their lot size, but they want to do a kitchen bump out or something. Maybe they should be able to do that so they can stay in the house and make it work for their living situation. The second is a flexibility in height when the house is...
Before you go on, sorry. Sure. Mm-hmm. What's to prevent then a developer from doing the maximum size and then coming back the week after saying, I'm going to do a remodel and add another X square feet?
Good code to say, you know, a house that's older than 50 years can do this, have this exception, because there is the house limit, and then there's, you know, all the exceptions are usually caveated with clarity qualifiers like that.
I suggest it's not just 50 years, it's probably some kind of tiny, smaller homes that were built between 50 years and 5 years ago.
Yeah, but a time limit. This also includes the flexibility in height for houses whose old foundations are being replaced. There are a lot of houses, older houses, that the foundations are crumbling and people want to do seismic upgrades and or just replace the foundation so it can be on a steadier foundation. But if the house itself is already over the height limit and they want to replace that, it's going to take them further above the height limit. So this proposal, the idea here is that they could improve the basement and improve the foundation. And if their height of the house isn't changing, then we would allow some flexibility there.
So how much does that happen? So you're talking about lifting the house up, redoing the foundation, putting it back down again.
I think it's happening more and more because in homes that were built like 100 years ago, the cement that they use is starting to fail because it was a different mix than what we use now. And so it's beginning to be actually a sort of a booming employment for the city in terms of, as people are going around thinking they're going to go and just get their home strapped for the first time and do the seismic, they're finding out that they can't strap it because when they go to drill into it, the foundations are actually starting to crumble.
I would like to have the numbers as to how many homes are being lifted up and put the foundation
We have several pictures of it, and I know just amongst staff, depending on which neighborhood you live in, some people are like, that's happening all over, and other people are like, that's not happening at all. But it depends on, it's an age. And
so I read about some house in Southeast where they're adding a whole additional story. Is that?
Underneath?
No, like they were adding a story. I guess they're raising the roof, adding a story. Is that allowed?
That's
allowed under these code changes as well?
Well.
Or overlay?
I think the premise is that the size limitations that Morgan discussed are is where you would start. Right, it's, you know, it could possibly meet the height and building coverage and the size limits, etc. If it's an older home, we're going to have to figure out how to define how much of that older home needs to exist. In this case, we're not talking about adding another floor on top. We're talking about providing repairs for the foundation. And while they're doing that, a lot of people are finding, I might as well dig out and do a finished basement or something in the basement. So that we'll have to explore.
Yeah, I'm just saying that if this is also a trend that's going to be occurring, more people are adding additional stories because they want to stay in their neighborhoods and they have kids and they want to expand with in place. How are we?
Yeah, I think the concept that in that situation they would have to meet the size limits that Morgan discussed. If someone additions have to meet this. And in addition to, like, a whole story.
You know, I just, the SDC waiver language jumped out at me, and it raises two issues. Dan, I got a preview recently about inclusionary housing and what's going to come to council and the menu of incentives that are being considered, tax abatements, CET abatements, FAR, the traditional things. Are SDCs part of that mix, or have you taken them out?
I believe they are still part of the mix, if you're doing 60% affordable.
Okay. Yeah. So, not all SDCs are the same. Some are forward-looking, some are backward-looking. The question I'm going to ask every time an SDC waiver comes up that impacts transportation, parks, and the two utilities is... What is the cost, and is this good policy? Now, on the ADUs, one of the things that was compelling for me when we had that debate is that people were building ADUs illegally. They weren't pulling a permit. They weren't coming to the city. So we were concerned about illegal, potentially unsafe ADUs. By waiving the SDCs, we essentially said we're going to make it a lower barrier process come in, and that was one. And that was one of the rationales, including we wanted to incentivize the ADUs. When we start getting into housing choice flexibility and making the system more user-friendly, I want to be careful that we're not being overly reliant on SDC charges, because I know it's tempting, it's sort of baked into the system, let's just waive them. But at some point, there's a real cost. We waived SDCs in Old Town Chinatown. We do with affordable housing meets a certain criteria. Well, at some point, if you keep going down that path, we have to have other revenues to backfill the lost revenue. And that's particularly true in transportation and the parks and the two utilities. So I just want to preview. I'll come anytime there's a proposed SDC waiver, I'm going to ask, what is the cost in terms of lost revenue? And why is that the best tool versus some other tool that doesn't take money out of the pockets of our cash-strapped utilities?
And just to clarify, this SDC waiver mention in our proposal is not to waive SDCs for all of this. It's to pursue added flexibility for housing conversions. One of the appendices in our report that you'll see, Appendix A, B, by our architects, DECA Architecture, they took a look at, okay, if you had a ranch house and you wanted to convert, what are the obstacles? Not just from the zoning code perspective, but building code, seismic, sprinklers, et cetera. What if you took a four square? And I think you'll find it really interesting to look at those floor plans, because everyone likes to look at houses anyway, right? But it shows that it's pretty difficult to convert an existing house. But we're also concerned with demolition. So what can we do to level the playing field, provide incentives for existing housing stock to remain and potentially to be converted into two units?
So would the code say you can only do this if you are preserving the current house?
Right.
And that's
right.
That's the idea.
That's the idea behind Recommendation 7.
And then building code flexibility, I think, doesn't the state set building codes? We can, what can
yes.
we do?
Yes, yeah. What we've learned.
So the building code, state building code, has a process to review potential amendments or exceptions or changes to the building code and what they apply from the international building code specific to Oregon. That process comes up every several years, and so this recommendation is, as we start developing programs and more incentives for encouraging retention of existing houses, that we would continue a legislative path to find some additional flexibility to essentially make it a little more, or I should say a little less disruptive to the existing structure to retrofit it for additional units.
And there was also, I think what I found enlightening about the report also talked about that Portland has taken some codes and gone far and beyond what the state requires, like for seismic and for sound insulation. So those might be within our realm of influence within the city.
Well, yes, and there's a reason that we did that.
Yeah.
And
I'm
still concerned that we've basically allowed trees to be cut down in poorer neighborhoods with some of the amendments that were made. What does it mean by city program resources that would facilitate conversions?
So similarly, like BDS currently has a FER program, the Field Issuance Remodel Program, it's resources and program guidance to help applicants through that building permit process. One of the things that the appendix also identified is one of the challenges for older homes is they don't meet current models for sound transmission assemblies, floor assemblies, and so forth, because they're lath and plaster, they're not modern materials. As there's more experience, more exposure with these structures, program guides can help show applicants other ways to use older materials to meet the current requirements and sort of make that process easier.
So basically technical and financial assistance.
So who from Development Services has been involved in this project?
Kristen Cooper, who's here today. She's been at all of our stakeholder advisory committee members, but we've also been keeping Paul Scarlett and Rebecca Issa up to date on our progress.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a lot of complicated changes, and we want
yes.
to make sure that Development Services is able to implement it.
Absolutely.
Well, in Commissioner, part of how we learned about these difficulties and limitations was by working with the building side of BDS as well. So we have one more topic. Ready to move on to skinny lots, and then we have about 45 minutes left.
Thanks, Joe. So finally, we looked at ways to improve development on narrow lots, and these are on the back page of your four-page summary. So as Joe mentioned earlier, there are historic plats that were recorded at the turn of the last century before modern zoning was in place. And some of these older plats were created with 25 or 33-foot wide lots. And this map up on the screen shows the concentration of these narrow plats in various parts of the city. So they're not equally distributed. They're sort of in various various places around town. State law requires cities to recognize these lots as discrete sellable parcels, but cities have the ability to determine when they are developable. Currently, in R5 zoned areas where these platted lots exist, they must be vacant for at least 5 years to be built on individually. However, development on these lots has led to confusion because the resulting lot sizes are more in line with what you would see in the R2.5 zone. And since the lot size pattern is dependent on the underlying plat and not the zone, areas that are directly across the street from each other may be developed very differently, even if they are in the same zone. So recommendation 8 essentially acknowledges that the skinny lots in the R5 zone are not intuitive and don't reflect the lot size pattern. These lots are also located in areas close to centers and corridors and provide additional options for smaller, fee simple home ownership. So this proposal would rezone these historically narrow lots to R2.5. So this series of slides compares current R2.5 zoning. So this is just showing where 2.5 zone exists in the city today, plus the recent changes that are being proposed with the new comp plan. So just sort of toggle back and forth a little bit there. And finally, the recommended rezone of narrow lots near centers and corridors. So this new extent of R2.5 zoning would account for about 10% of the single dwelling zones, but less than 5% of the total city land area.
But we reviewed these in the comprehensive plan and looking at the comprehensive plan map. What analysis have you done to say that there's enough services that can add that much more 2.5 zoning?
Right, so that analysis still needs to be done. Some of these areas, things we have to look at are levels of street improvements and infrastructure. But the changes that you saw with this last round of the comp plan changes were fairly select based on areas that were already designated our 2.5 zones. So we looked at sort of a review of those existing comp plan R2.5 areas. This is a little bit of a different approach. We're looking at areas that are already platted at R2.5, essentially.
So right, but they were platted as a historical accident back in the 1880s. So to say that just because they're platted that way, we're going to change the zone, I don't think makes much sense.
Correct. And remember, this is a concept plan. So what we're really saying here is on these lots, the approach that we want to explore is to used R2.5 zoning, and there's other provisions that Morgan's going to describe. But that whole process of developing code, Commissioner, that's a whole separate legislative process, and it needs to be able to make findings, just like you're saying, about adequacy of public services to do that rezone and the like.
Other than that they do have the underlying plat, we didn't get requests or recommendations in the comp plan map process to change all of those, especially in North and Northeast Portland. We didn't do that.
Right, but that was part of the, we were focused in the comprehensive plan on R2.5s that already have that comprehensive plan designation. So by having that designation, we've already done the analysis, at least to put the designation down, that they have the facilities that they're appropriate for the location. We had already made that decision, and what we're trying to do, it's really in the spirit of this, remove the barrier of having to do the rezoning, do the zoning, and let the market determine, follow through with the path that we had set in the comprehensive plan in the 80s. This is revisiting the development on these pre-platted lots. Their location is sort of an accident of history about where that practice was used. The motivation to open them up to this different development based on the standards that Morgan's about to describe seemed consistent with the thinking in the rest of the proposal to reduce the size of houses makes whatever is built there fit into the context of a neighborhood, but also open opportunities in neighborhood for smaller units. So today, you know, through a different set of rules, development of those lots is allowed. This sort of liberalizes that a bit, but adds the standards Morgan's going to describe. And this we thought was a step too far to do with an overlay, and decided the clearest sort of way to represent it was to rezone the properties. All of that still has to happen as part of a future process, if the city council even supports the concept.
I guess let me just add one more thing. I think where we came at with this proposal, and I know we've had discussions at council before, and what the rules are now is that if there's a vacant skinny lot, then that lot can be developed on. And if there's a house straddling the lot line, if it's demolished, it would take 5 years to be able to develop on that. So that was the idea and what's codified today. If it's density we're talking about, then a 5,000 square foot lot that doesn't have an underlying lot line could do a duplex under our new proposal for the housing choice. So that's two units. So the idea here is, what if we allow that underlying lot line to be taken advantage of and have fee simple lots that can be sold off separately?
So Morgan, why don't you go through the development prototypes?
So recognizing we've got this additional land area under contemplation for our 2.5 zoning, recommendation number 9 is proposing several improvements to development in the zone. This is showing 4 variants of house development in the R2.5 zone. So where a house is being retained on the left lot, new rules would permit a property line adjustment to create flag lots and allow the existing house to remain. On lots where a house is being demolished, new houses would be required to be attached. On large vacant sites, those that are at least 5,000 square feet, 2 units would be required, either a duplex, like Sandra described, or a house with an ADU. And on other vacant sites, pre-existing lots can be confirmed or large lots divided for detached or attached houses.
What was the lot number 4 again?
So if you have vacant lots, there's nothing on there. You could either divide that lot or you could you take advantage of the pre-existing platted lots and put either attached or detached houses on there.
And what it says here is that you would have to do at least 2 units. You couldn't replace a what looks like a R5 house with another R5 house.
Right. In the R2.5 zone, we're saying on lots that are double-sized, 5,000 square feet, removing a single house and replacing with a single house, we're losing that unit potential. So we would require 2 units either as a duplex or you could do a house with an ADU. So that both of those would meet that standard.
So I think that's even more cause for looking at the neighborhoods where they are and deciding, did we really want R5 like we just said in the map, or did we... is there some reason to change to R2.5?
So recommendation 9 also includes additional height provisions for R2.5, thinking about the desired outlook for that zone. So like other zones, single houses on standard lots would be limited to 2.5 stories, like the house in the middle. Detached houses on narrow lots, like the house on the left, would be limited to 2 stories, and attached houses would be allowed to be 3 stories. So remember, in the R2.5 zone, the current height limit is 35 feet. So it essentially is anticipated that 3-story height limit currently. The final proposal relates to garages and parking on narrow lots. As you can see in this photo, the driveways occupy most of the front yard, remove available on-street parking, and take up space for street trees. Additionally, on these narrow houses, the width of the garage door is dominating the front facade and occupies much of the ground floor. The proposal would no longer allow street-facing garages for detached skinny houses, so this would leave room for on-street parking, larger front yards, and more street trees.
So even if somebody wanted to put a garage, they couldn't?
They couldn't put a garage, but let me get to the next slide. There's some solutions for parking. So the image in the upper left shows that in addition to on-street parking, if there are alleys present, you could have parking in a garage off the alley or parking pad off the alley, or shared parking between the 2 detached houses to parking in the rear. For attached houses, garages would be allowed if the driveways were combined and tucked under the first floor. So currently, garages aren't allowed for attached houses unless you go through a plan development process. So this is intended to give a little additional allowance for accommodating parking the cars. So with that, any additional questions on the narrow lot development proposals?
We totally realize all of this is very confusing the first time you hear it, and it's a lot to take in, and you're kind of torn both ways off and on all of this. And so we will obviously spend a lot of time with your staff and with you to walk you through some of this and have the discussions and be able to get all the data that you need.
We can talk about this for hours.
So now garages aren't allowed in attached houses?
Garages are not allowed unless you go through a plan development. Currently, yeah.
So just tell us.
So actually, it would seem to me that if we were allowing for more attached houses and have that prohibition in garages, there'd be a lot of neighborhood complaints that you're just crowding out all the on-street parking. So that's, it would seem like allowing for limited garages and attached housing would kind of ameliorate that complaint.
Right, and the trade-off in practice is each driveway eliminates on-street spaces. So when we saw townhouses built where it's driveway, 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 I think the reaction was that was inappropriate too. So maybe there's some balance, but
part of what we're doing, there's a number of recommendations that sort of encourage or incentive building attached versus detached skinny houses because they're a little less consistent with the form that we typically see in these neighborhoods. But for the driveway issue, for the parking issue, we heard a lot of concern about parking in general, providing opportunities to allow for parking. But a lot of this is tied to the idea of retaining as much on-street parking as possible. So the combining of driveways, for instance, the shared driveway down in the back between two houses preserves a lot more of that curb street parking.
So I note that we've got public hearings on this on the 9th and the 16th. Are either of those in the evening? So, colleagues, I'd like to suggest that maybe on one of those days we have an afternoon hearing, take an hour for dinner, and then allow people to come and testify, because I'm absolutely certain there's going to be a lot of concern about this, and we should give people the opportunity to not have to take a day off to come and talk about it. It's kind of reminiscent of the Southwest Community Planner in my mind.
Just as a point of personal privilege, I have to go to see David Sedaris the night of the 9th, so I would be available then.
So maybe the 16th, that also gives people more notice.
So if there are no more questions about narrow lots, I'm going to pass it over to Tyler, who's going to talk a little bit about our economic analysis.
There we go. My name is Tyler Bump. I'm an economic planner at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We conducted some economic analysis and with Jerry Johnson of Johnson Economics to do a couple things. What we did is we looked at some prototypes that were developed by our architectural consultant, and then Jerry Johnson ran those through his pro forma model to do three things. One was to make sure that the proposals are feasible within the market so that what we're proposing and the concept plan could be built if that's the ultimate outcome of the project. The second is to get a sense of the scale of change. How frequently would these new alternative housing prototypes be used? What's the impact on redevelopment and demolitions in the single family neighborhood? And the third thing is, where are we likely to see these changes? So with that, I want to go into this, the sort of overview of the big findings. I think the first thing was a little generally surprising for us, and that is by shrinking the overall allowable size of the single-family structures to 2,500 square feet, or 0.5 FAR, it essentially reduced the likelihood of redevelopment and demolitions in the single-family neighborhoods because you reduce the overall yield of that building. So less square footage means that new construction product will be worth less and the existing structure could be worth more. And so we saw a reduction of about 8 to 10% of development or demolitions and redevelopment in the single-family zones.
You said that was a surprise to you?
It was a little bit of a surprise because we're proposing...
It seems intuitive to me.
Well, it's intuitive, but we're also proposing additional units in these new alternative housing prototypes. So some of the thought was that the new units might offset it. But what we found was that when redevelopment does occur, it's most likely that we will see multiple units instead of a single family structure.
Well, just in the intuitive part was, I think, more going from 4,000 to 2,500, how much of an impact that would have, and also that what was, I guess, a surprise is that looking at the land, it already was valued for a bigger house, right, like a 4,000 square foot house minimum, and we were just surprised that how much of a change that made, not that it made a change.
And it's pretty marginal over the long term. It's not going to decrease our total housing capacity or our ability to meet our housing growth needs, the metro forecast that we were talking about earlier. So it is a little bit marginal, but it shifts the demolitions from new construct from single family to multi units.
Right, and so to the extent that there still is demand for single family houses, especially in certain neighborhoods, they'll still be pressure to scrape and build new, depending on what's there on the lot. That it only can be a 2,500 foot house, that just takes some time. And what Tyler is going to talk about next is the way this program works is that it may be more likely that if demo takes place, you end up getting two units rather than just one. It doesn't necessarily increase the overall amount of expected demos.
And in the case where we do see multiple units, it's likely that those multiple units, the duplex, the triplex scenarios will come in at an overall, or they could come in at an overall lower price point than a larger single family structure, because those units have to still fit within the 2,500 square foot allowance or whatever the FAR is. So where you could have a 2,500 square foot single family structure, you can now have 1,250 square foot duplex, two of those. And so by shrinking that size, the general overall price point could potentially be lower. I always caveat that with the market determines what that price is and the sale price, and there's always examples of higher cost duplexes or higher cost skinny home new construction, but generally those are going to be lower than a larger single family structure. The other thing that I talked a lot about with Jerry Johnson, who did this economic analysis with us also, is the market depth of these smaller units. We're seeing a general slowdown, really, of larger family new construction that's happening in the single-family neighborhoods. A lot of that has to do with what our economy looks like, and Joe brought up the jobs piece earlier. We don't have a huge amount of households and families that can pay $800,000 for a new construction single-family house. And so when you're able to bring those smaller units at a lower price point online, your market depth is there's more people that are able to purchase those. And subsequently, that unit is sitting on the market for a lower amount of time, and it's easier to market that as well. So the response from the private sector is likely to be positive for these smaller units and the alternative housing prototypes. This is the result of the comparison of, there's some nice pink dots on there, of the prototypes that we're looking at. And so on the left-hand side is the single-family R5, 2,500 square foot lot proposal. And then as you scale up, you see the increase in density, and the increase in density that allows a more likely return in redevelopment. So what's happening is the narrow lot skinny is the most attractive scenario, and I'll get into the price points on that in a little bit. And then after that is the triplex at the second highest, and then you get to the duplex scenario and the single family. And this sort of helps illustrate that when we do see redevelopment occur, it's likely that we'll see multiple units instead of one single family structure. The price point for these is going to vary, but generally in that narrow lot new construction, you're looking at about $400,000 and $450,000 for a new construction skinny house. Could be delivered at that price point, which is anywhere between 100 and 120% MFI for a three-person household. So it is within the realm of affordability for Portlanders. Not affordable housing, as we talk about it, is 60% or less, but 100 to 120% MFI. This is an example. This is from Johnson Economics memo on the analysis that he had done. He did a couple simplified pro formas to walk folks through to show where the cost savings are happening to bring those multiple units online at a lower price point. In addition to the smaller square footage, it's the fact that you can spread the cost of the land across multiple units. So if your land acquisition is, say, $200,000, or in this case, it is $126,000, about $130,000. That is spread across two units. So your land cost is cut in half when you have a duplex versus a single family structure. Your construction costs go up a little bit because you have building code things, you have firewall, soundproof, additional infrastructure. You've got more water, different infrastructure pieces going in that increases the per square foot cost, but overall that unit comes in at a lower price point. And this is an example of the price per square foot and what the attainable price per square foot is for a new construction in each of these. It's about $300 a square foot for a large family, single family new construction, and about $345 a square foot. So the price per square foot is a little higher, but the overall cost is a little bit lower for those smaller units as well.
So to what extent in our forecasting are we assuming historically low interest rates into the future?
Right, that's a good question. We're still going to build the housing to the extent that it's going to be homeownership. It's definitely going to be a function of what interest rates are. Those folks that bought houses in the 1980s that paid a 20% interest rate and now we're at a 3.8 or 4% definitely impacts demand a little bit, and the forecast does not account for changes in interest rates for sure. But we could see more rental coming online. That'll shift depending on the interest rates.
I mean, right now, you know, for certain eligible households, they can leverage about $400,000 worth of debt for about a $2,000 or a little over $2,000 a month. That's not going to last forever. And when we get out from this historic trough, if the Fed makes a couple of moves, I mean, we could see a dramatic change. If interest rates spike to 5 or 6%, it's going to dramatically affect the people's buying power.
But would the market respond to that in part by dropping the sales price of a home, understanding that people's monthly costs have gone up in other ways?
There could be a market response to that, depending on if there's still demand for those housing products or for that price point for the housing. The other piece is down payment, too, is the sort of financial instruments and the ability to hit a 20% down payment, or if we have first-time home buyer opportunities where you have lower down payment, what's happening with the financial markets there. It's relative, first-time home buyers, there's some attractive programs out there right now. So the down payment is a big component of home ownership as well.
So I'm curious, it seems the impression I get is there's a lot of rich people that want really humongous houses. And if we reduce this allowable size of houses, then those won't be available here. Do we think that means that fewer rich people will move here because they'll go somewhere else, they're allowed to build bigger houses? I mean, how's that going to work?
I think Santa Barbara and cities like that in California totally, you know, show that you can put a limited size, and what happens is the price keeps going up. There's still it doesn't really affect the demand.
I actually think that there's almost an irrational component of our market right now. And we can make all these assumptions, but if it's a smaller house, I don't think the market's functioning in a way that necessarily means you have more smaller homes, more middle-class people are going to be able to afford them. If you don't have the bigger homes, then people that have more resources are going to bid up the price of the next class of homes. And I, we have a friend in off of Fremont in around the 30s, 20s, who recently, he's a poster child for what we're talking about here. They're going to move into an ADU on their property and rent out their house. That's the way they're going to manage their retirement years. Makes a lot of sense. They bought a small house across the street. He's very handy. They demolished it. They put a big Craftsman. They put it on the market for $800,000, which is what the market is for a Craftsman in that area. Well, they had a number of offers, and they sold it for all cash for $1 million. Well, that's irrational. I mean, I don't want to say the word irrational. We're in uncharted territory when people. And by the way, it was not Steve's prototypical out-of-state millionaire coming to town. It was just someone who lived five blocks away that wanted an extra couple of bedrooms, and they sold their house for a very good price, and with the financing, they were able to get work. They had the cash. They went into a bigger house.
Well, so and just on the spirit of interest rates could change, construction costs could change if demand goes down. These variables are the one thing we're sure of is that they will change. part of what this whole proposal opens up is a kind of resiliency in the city, where if you look at older cities that have gone through this cycle a few times, and we've seen it here as well, when the price has really bid up, it may be that a duplex is converted into a single-family house because somebody wants that location so much and has the resources. What we're opening up the opportunity for is that other cycle as well, where you can have an appropriately sized house and get utilization of it even when the market's down. So this is a long-term play, really, more than just the next 20 years.
When we were talking about with our stakeholder advisory committee about the equity component of this project, it really came down to generational equity. It's clear generational equity. It's clear that if you bought into the Portland housing market 20 years ago, you're sitting pretty nice. You can sell a house for a handsome profit and buy the new $800,000 Craftsman that's built on the street. And that actually shifted our focus for this project to how do we use our single dwelling zones to meet the needs of current and future residents, always thinking about, you know, who's moving here, whose children are being born here. Our children won't be able to afford to live in Portland because all the houses are $1 million this side of 82nd Avenue. And was really, I think, a great way to think about the intergenerational equity we're trying to achieve.
And I think we got pulled into, although it's not affordable housing, like program housing, it started to resonate on a fair housing kind of issue, where the more exclusive we get, the less opportunities there are for a breadth of households.
We're making huge bets about the market. I'm not arguing with you, but we're making huge bets about the market. And the reason the opportunity language, I keep bumping my head against that, is that in the affordable context, we've taken the market out of it. We've put permanent affordability in. So we're building permanently affordable, and the housing bond, if it passes, will be the next big chapter in that. But we're building social housing with huge restrictions on the in terms of caps on price. So we're creating a social commodity that we can regulate the price to provide opportunity for people of low income means for a generation. What we're trying to do here is anticipate a lot of market forces and work within a market that is operating right now in a fever pitch. And we're saying, boy, wouldn't it be great to have more houses at $450,000? I can't, and by what definition is that an affordable house?
Well,
what I'm observing is that people are bidding up even those mid-level houses in areas that have very strong schools. So the Grant cluster is within, you know, a quarter mile of Grant. We're creating effectively a gated community of houses that are selling for $800,000 or more, because obviously people want access to a great school and the transportation. But the way we deal with this issue on the affordable side is we take the market out of it.
But we're also looking that the demand is 80% for multifamily, so we're only talking about 20% of the future demand. So as important as all this discussion is, we're still talking of a very, you know, a quarter of the people that are moving here or less. So I think it's important to remember that.
I mean, it seems to me, though, that one basic assumption we're making about the market seems to be not that big a leap, which is that we assume that 5,000 square foot houses are going to cost more in any market than 1,250-foot duplexes. And it seems like in terms of the demolition projections, we're going to have fewer demolitions overall, no demolitions of a 2,000 square foot house to replace it with a 4,000 square foot house, because 4,000 square foot houses won't be allowed, but some demolitions to replace a 2,000 square foot house with two 1,250 square foot ones.
So what are the peer cities that you look to that sort of give us guidance? They're going through a similar process of trying to strike this balance.
Well, and I'll turn it to Morgan and Sandra about the research that was done in the project. So,
we're a little bit groundbreaking here, so that makes it tough when we're trying to create models and develop assumptions in terms of our economic analysis what these new housing types will produce. However, there has been some foray into some of these housing types in Vancouver, BC. San Francisco is watching us to see what we're doing, because they are facing, of course, similar challenges in terms of their housing situation. Denver is also looking at similar types of rezoning proposals.
As far as precedent goes, what's interesting is it's older places. That they have either been allowing something like this for a long time, and even in our city, we have great examples of where it used to be allowed, and places evolved to be some of our most attractive neighborhoods, most diverse in the sense of size of units, not necessarily racially, but have a most diverse housing stock. So a little bit, we're learning from our own pattern, our own DNA in Portland to try this.
By the way, in Denver, when they redeveloped the train station area and did their little version of our river district, the one striking difference was there's no affordable housing. It's all market, which is remarkable.
Can you just ask a clarifying question about the skinny lots? I see that you've got it mapped within study area and with outside the study area. Is the proposal to make all skinny lots plats 2.5?
No. So what the concept reflects is just those skinny lot plat areas that are within that quarter mile map distance. Just in terms of raw numbers, we're talking about approximately 13,000 of the 15,000 skinny lots that are in the city. Pretty ballpark numbers. And of course, we are still talking about, you know, individually analyzing those different areas. So as we develop the specific maps, those numbers will change.
And we would like to keep the housing choice map consistent with the skinny lot map. So if, as you were discussing today, or as you deliberate, and based on the testimony you receive, you decide to shrink the quarter mile, then we would shrink it also for the skinny lots lot proposal.
And outside of wherever, it just confirmed that this is true. Our thinking now is outside of where this proposal is allowed, development of skinny lots would not be allowed. So that boundary it's just clearing it up once and for all.
So then how do you get around the takings issue? That's why we had skinny lots development in the first place, is because property owners said, well, it's a platted lot. The state requires you to let me build on it.
Yeah, you don't. So in those situations, property owners that are affected by that land use regulation can still file a claim and seek a waiver of that prohibition.
Fixing it, then, are we?
Except, you know, if you take sort of the long view, which a lot of this proposal is looking at the next 20, 30, 40 years, eventually those properties will amortize, they'll sell, they'll convey to new owners, and the new owners won't have the same ability to waive those regulations. So,
to a certain extent, by having a larger supply of these lots, which are actually, this housing type is in big demand, it takes pressure off of the versions of it that aren't within whatever area we designate. But it doesn't eliminate that possibility.
Could one of you send me a link to an online map? Because I'd like to drill down in, like, Rose City Park and West Portland Park and other places.
Part of that is why we wrote conceptual here, because we didn't get down to each lot. We were going to make it neon.
Dan, I have a question, since you're the presiding officer. Do you want to go around the horn and make sure we have all the questions, or do you want us to do that by email after this work session?
We could go around the horn. Yeah, we got 15 minutes here. I think there's been a lot of good questions being asked right now. I don't know if anybody has any additional ones. So I don't.
Yeah. I probably will have additional ones after this meeting, so I reserve the right to send emails afterwards. I just want to return, actually, to the question Commissioner Fish raised about why not just change the base zoning? And I understand that the overlay zones are part of the code and they're not like some trick, but I was wondering how feasible it would be to sort of take a stab at, if instead of having an overlay zone, we just converted more places to, is there some way you could achieve the same goals by just saying more areas are 2.5 with some restrictions, which might look sort of more straightforward to some people?
If you rezoned everything to R2.5, or this whole area to R2.5, you would also be allowing land divisions for fee simple detached houses, because that's what's allowed in R2.5. So this is a little bit of a hybrid between the R5 and the size restrictions that Morgan was talking about applies to all lots citywide. The housing choice is a subset, and in this geography, which I'm sure you'll talk more about that geography.
So what you're proposing here is significantly different than anything that we would achieve by changing the base zoning in the same places.
I think it would be really helpful for us to do a table for you and show the differences and in what areas that there's differences and in what areas it's the same. And so we can do that.
But it basically, this, for ownership, this becomes a condominium product. And that's happening now in Portland, but it's a little exotic still. But that's part of what the changes would be if you want to do a duplex and have an ownership in an interior R5 lot. But you still have a 5,000 square foot lot.
You know, I think this has been a fantastic work session and conversation, and it is very complicated stuff. And, you know, for me, and I'll have follow-up questions, and I think we have a meeting scheduled to go over this and something else just in greater detail. I'm going to keep coming back to the housing overlay zone and the idea that it applies to select neighborhoods, and I want to better understand whether it can be tailored, what are the trade-offs, and to what extent are we using an overlay zone in a way that's perhaps overly aggressive to accomplish the goal? I'm also interested in Commissioner Fritz's comment she made at the beginning of the hearing about to what extent is any of this required following the comp plan versus desirable or laudable but required to get to the. I mean, I get the idea that if we say this is industrial land and we decide to use it for something else, we got to go find some additional industrial land. There's some black and white issues we deal with. This I want to have a better understanding about our options and then the trade-offs, the costs. Because I think we all start from a premise that we want to target density in places that can accommodate it. So, you know, South Waterfront, transit centers, corridors, and places like that. To the extent we have an overlay that looks, you know, very expansive, you know, I want to really drill down on the trade-offs and other options. On any time SDCs come up, I'll ask, you know, my series of questions, including, I guess as a fallback, is it a deferral rather than a waiver? Because if the council doesn't agree with me on an SDC, I want to make sure at least we have a way to recapture it at the back end when someone is selling their house for a premium. And then I think the question about to what extent do we have to further incentivize ADUs beyond the current incentives, and what has been the historical performance under our current rules, and do we need to go further? And then I know you had a lot of stakeholders. I think at the first hearing, it would be helpful to frame this a little bit with giving us a flavor of what were some of the concerns you heard from stakeholders that did this. I know that, you know, you didn't take a final vote on this, so this is an effort to kind of come up with a plan. There's some aspects are consensus-based, others were sharply divided. And I think having a little primer on that would be helpful to sort of set our expectations as we start hearing from public members.
Actually, that was going to be my question. I'd like to know now, what were the big issues that the Planning and Sustainability Commission discussed? What was the testimony? And where were there any places where the votes were close?
So let me back up a little bit. We, as we said, we've been working on this for about a year. We did two questionnaires. The first one, we had about 7,000 respondents, and that was, what are people's concerns about this issue? What new great ideas do you have to share with us? At that time, which was in December of 2015, it was affordability, neighborhood context in terms of scale and design, and demolitions were the main ones. Once we had a proposal, we took it out to the community, and we had 8-week public process this summer and had many open houses. I think several of you attended some of those open houses. And we also had a questionnaire and an online open house. So we had about 8,000 people going to the online open house, which is, of course, available 24/7, not just in our 2 hours in the evening. And we had 2,500 respondents to the questionnaire there. Then the top three findings from that, from the respondents, was that we're going in the right direction for scale of houses. Generally, I think that was at 64% of folks felt like we were going in the right direction for that. disagreement, wide disagreement on the housing types and the map. Definitely on our stakeholder advisory committee, we heard maybe it should be two blocks from the centers and corridors, and then the why not everywhere, which you'll hear both of that. The housing types was why only two units? Why do you care how many units are in each if the bulk of the structure is the same? So that was finding number two. And finding number three was affordability. Is this adding any affordability? In what world is $450,000 an affordable product? That was from the questionnaires itself. And then we also received 1,400 open comments from emails, letters, comment cards, flip charts, et cetera. And those mimicked what we heard in the questionnaire. So those were closely aligned. So that's, I think.
What about at the Planning and Sustainability Commission?
And so we did not hold a hearing at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We had a briefing with them, was it last week?
Last week.
Because we're not in the legislative process right now, we were really coming to you for guidance on the resolution and how to move forward with the legislative process. And two of the commission members, though, were on our Stakeholder Advisory Committee, both Eli Spivak and Teresa St. Martin. And they'll be speaking, Teresa and Kat will be speaking at the hearing next week.
So the council hearing is the first time that the public at large has had to come in and voice their opinions.
That's right.
And again, this is a resolution. You're going to have an entire process after this. This is more like getting to a term sheet. You can think of it as like, here's a general, the general areas of agreement that you all come up with so that we can go write code, so that we don't write a code that's so far off from where you all are. And so it was an attempt to get halfway down sort of the funnel, take a snapshot, get where all of you are at, be able to do that, and then run the traditional legislative process.
Just in response to Commissioner Fritz's last comment, we did have these open houses, which at least the one in Multnomah Village was very well attended, where these concepts were tossed out there and people could speak their mind.
No, I heard that, but not in front of a body that makes a recommendation, either the Planning and Sustainability Commission or us. So I think we should probably plan on quite a long hearing.
Familiar with the cop plan and use of all the papers.
Yeah.